Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We're going to try to cover a lot of ground tonight. We're actually going to try to finish the book of Judges tonight. No, let's be more positive than that. We're not going to try. We're going to do it. We're going to finish the book of Judges tonight. And it can be done for this reason. Most of what we're about to read is narrative. It's a story that really does tell itself, doesn't require a tremendous amount of explanation or comment, even though it is my penchant to comment on such things. But we'll try to just read out the story itself, which starts in chapter 19 by saying, "Now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel." That's a recurring theme that we've been seeing in the book of Judges, that the reason all of these things were happening, these oppressions by the enemies in the surrounding areas, and then God sending a judge who would free those pockets of Israel, those tribes of Israel for periods of time. There'd be peace in Israel. The people would get comfortable. But every time they would end up doing their own thing again. And the reason was there was no king in Israel. And that theme keeps recurring. The very last thing you read in the book of Judges is, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And that's the second time that that's stated in the book of Judges. So the compiler of the book really is stressing that, really wants his readers to understand that the reason these things kept occurring was that there was two problems. Number one, no central king. And because there was no central king in Israel, you had individual tribes setting up individual leaders and then doing their own thing in contradistinction to what other tribes might be doing. And what we're going to read tonight is a war of all the tribes of Israel against the tribe of Benjamin and the near destruction of the tribe of Benjamin. So there's infighting. They've not only been fighting against their enemies, which is what we've been reading all the way through this book, their wars against their surrounding Gentile enemies, but now there's infighting among the tribes themselves. And so things have really reached a very chaotic state. And I think that the writer of the book of Judges held this particular story, which really takes up from chapter 19, verse 1, to the end of the book. He really held this story to the end, I think, because it shows the pinnacle of the disruption and infighting and sinfulness and just the depth of the level of depravity that was taking place in Israel by this point. And when you get out of the book of Judges, we have the short book of Ruth, which is where we'll be going next. And then you get into 1 and 2 Samuel and the introduction, finally, of kings in Israel. And then, of course, the Davidic covenant, the next covenant that you see in the Old Testament. The first covenant you see is the covenant with Noah, and then the covenant made with Abraham. And then the next one that you're going to see chronologically in the development of Israel is the Davidic covenant. So we're going to read about that in 1 and 2 Samuel. So this is the state of Israel at the end of the period of the judges, and the solution appears to be we need a king. And that helps us understand why, when you get into 1 Samuel and you see Israel asking Samuel, "We want a king," you can see why. And even though Samuel is going to tell them, you don't know what you're asking for. If you have a king, he's going to take your money, and he's going to take the best stuff, and he's going to take the best women, and he's going to tax you like crazy. And they say, "But we want a king." And you won't really understand that desire for a king if you don't understand everything we've been looking at in the book of Judges. That chaos is now ensuing in Israel because, as the writer says frequently, there's no king in Israel. And they think a king is the solution to their problems. So first you get the setup. And the setup starts in chapter 19, verse 1. "Now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel that there was a certain Levite who was staying in a remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judea. But his concubine played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and was there for a period of 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant and a pair of donkeys. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. And the father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. Now it came about on the fourth day that they got up early in the morning, and he prepared to go. And the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and then afterward you may go." So both of them sat down and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry." Then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he spent the night there again. And on the fifth day, he arose to go early in the morning, and the girl's father said, "Please sustain yourself and wait until the afternoon." So both of them ate. And when the man arose to go along with his concubine and servant, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold, now the day is drawn to a close. Please spend the night. Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here that your heart may be merry. Then tomorrow you may arise early for your journey so that you may go home." But the man was not willing to spend the night. So he arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus, which is Jerusalem. And there were with him a pair of saddled donkeys. His concubine also was with him. And when they were near Jebus, the day was almost gone, and the servant said to his master, "Please come and let us turn aside to this city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." Now, what that tells you is this is before Jerusalem had been conquered. This is when the Jebusites are still living in the area, and hence the name Jebus for the city itself. They are the Jebusites or Jebusites living in the area. So his master said in verse 11, "We will not turn into the city of foreigners, who are not the sons of Israel, but we will go on as far as Gibeah." And he said to his servant, "Come and let us approach one of these places, and we will spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah." And they passed along, and they went their way, and the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to the tribe of Benjamin. And they turned aside there in order to enter and lodge in Gibeah. And when they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. Now, you may recall back in the Law of Moses that there were actually rules about this, that if a stranger came in, especially somebody of your own kindred, that you were to take them into the house. You weren't to leave them out in the cold. But they've gone into the city of Benjamin, the city of Gibeah, and they find themselves sitting in the town square hoping that somebody will see them there and take them in. And as the story unfolds, you're going to find that this city, Gibeah, has some deeply entrenched problems. "Then behold," verse 16, "an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjamites. And he lifted up his eyes, and he saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, 'Where are you going, and where do you come from?' And he said to him, 'We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remotest part of the hill country of Ephraim, for I am from there, and I went to Bethlehem in Judah. But I am now going to my house, and no man will take me into his house. Yet there is both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and the young man who is with your servants, and so there's no lack of anything.'" In other words, he's saying, "We're not going to cost anybody anything. We've got our own food, we've got our own wine, we've got our own provision. I've got straw for my donkey. There's plenty here to take care of me, and still nobody will take me in." The old man said, verse 20, "Peace to you. Only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square." So we took him into his house and gave the donkeys fodder, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. And while they were making merry, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding on the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came into your house so that we may have relations with him." Okay, now this would be a good reason for getting somebody out of the city square and into the protective custody of your house. What does this remind you of, by the way? Taking in a stranger? Sodom and Gomorrah. And I think there's a direct connection here because we know how God treated Sodom and Gomorrah. We know that God was adamant in his judgment against them, raining down fiery hail on them to destroy them for the wickedness of the sin that we're reading about right here among Benjamites. And so this is how depraved Israel has become as they have wandered further and further from God, from the law of Moses, from Sinai, and are now involved in this sort of treachery and debauchery and sexual immorality. Verse 23, then the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not commit this act of foolishness. Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine." Does that sound familiar? It's the same thing that we read about. Again, there's a direct parallel between this and what happened in Sodom. So here's my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish, but do not commit such an act of folly against this man. But the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them. They raped her and they abused her all night until morning, and then they let her go at the approach of dawn. As the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until full daylight. And when her master arose in the morning and opened the door of the house and went out to go his way, then behold, his concubine was lying on the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, "Get up and let us go," but there was no answer. Then he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and went to his home. In other words, she was dead. And so she had died from the abuse in the night, and he took her dead body, put it on the donkey, and took her home. Verse 29 then tells us that when he entered his home, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine and cut her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. 12 pieces to get to each of the 12 tribes other than Benjamin, since there were a total of 13, if you count the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh, as well as the Levites as a tribe. So he sent out cut pieces of her murdered body, her murdered, raped body, to the other 12 tribes of Israel to stir them up against Benjamin. This is a gruesome story. Verse 30, and it came about that all who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up." So like I said, that's the setup. Now, the result is going to be the destruction of one of the tribes of Israel. And when it looks like that tribe is at the point of going to be a ghost, there's not going to be any men for the next generation, and so there's going to be nobody to intermarry with Benjamin. There's also, at the very end of the book, going to be a solution. And it's very interesting, the solution, because they make a pact, the other tribes do, that they're not going to give any of their women to Benjamin because Benjamin, as a tribe, as a people group, they were responsible for the rape and the murder of this woman. So they're not going to give any of their women to Benjamin. And then there's going to be war, and all the young men of Benjamin are going to be wiped out at the will of God. And so you have this dilemma where the Benjamites, who have been given a land and been given a heritage and been given a promise, are also about to be completely dissolved. And so they also have to come up with a solution for it. And that's the end of the story. So now you've got the introduction, and I've told you the end. Here's the body of the story now. Everything so far was indeed introduction. So good. I'm glad one person enjoyed that. Chapter 20, verse 1. Then all the sons of Israel from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, came out, and the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. And the chiefs of all the people, even all the tribes of Israel, took their stand in the assembly of the people of God 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Now the sons of Benjamin heard that the sons of Israel had gone up to Mizpah, and the sons of Israel said, "Tell us, how did this wickedness take place?" So the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, "I came with my concubine to spend the night at Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. But the men of Gibeah rose up against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me. Instead, they ravished my concubine so that she died. And I took hold of my concubine, and I cut her in pieces, and I sent her throughout the land of Israel's inheritance, for they have committed a lewd and a disgraceful act in Israel. Behold, all the sons of Israel, give your advice and counsel here." Then all the people arose as one man, saying, "Not one of us will go to his tent, nor will any of us return to his house. But now this is the thing that we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. And we will take 10 men out of 100 throughout the tribes of Israel, and 100 out of 1,000, and 1,000 out of 10,000 to supply food for the people, that they come to Gibeah of Benjamin, that they may punish them for all the disgraceful acts that they have committed in Israel." Thus all the men of Israel were gathered against the city, united as one man. Then the tribes of Israel sent men through the entire tribe of Benjamin, saying, "What is this wickedness that has taken place among you? Now then, deliver up the men, the worthless fellows in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove this wickedness from Israel." But the sons of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the sons of Israel. So they actually had a way out. All they had to do was deliver up the responsible ones, and that would have been the end of it. And you have 400,000 men ready to do war with you, ready to do battle. But they're going to go up in lots. They realize 400,000, maybe overkill. So we'll go up in groups, and you'll see in just a moment that God picks which group's going to go first. And so they have a way out, and yet the Benjamites protect the murderers rather than break ranks. And this is going to lead to all-out war within Israel. So the sons of Benjamin gathered from the cities of Gibeah to go out to battle against the sons of Israel. And from the cities on that day, the sons of Benjamin were numbered 26,000 men who draw the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who were numbered 700 choice men. So you've got 26,700 men. Hang on to that number. Out of these people, 700 choice men were left-handed. Each one could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. In other words, really good at this. Good fighters and good with a sling. And the men of Israel besides Benjamin were numbered 400,000 who draw the sword. All these were men of war. The reason I said hang on to that number, now this has nothing to do with the story, so take a breath. This is something I'm throwing in extra for free. I contend and have contended on our website on an audio Q&A and have even got some YouTube videos that folks have made and then a noted preterist responded to. I contend that in the Bible, the number 1,000 actually means 1,000. And that throughout the Bible, mathematics is a method by which God communicates and that the math is accurate math. The notion, unfortunately, is that, oh, those people way back then, oh, those silly, foolish folks who lived way back in the Old Testament, they used the number 1,000, and when they said 1,000, they just meant really big number we can't count up to. And so if you wanted to say a whole bunch of something, you just said, oh, there's 1,000 of them. And the examples that they often cite are things like the cattle on 1,000 hills are the Lord's. There, see, that just means great big number. Or David saying that a day in the courts of God are better than 1,000 anywhere else. See, it just means great big number. But I contend that throughout the Old Testament and certainly into the New and very specifically into Revelation 20, that when the Bible uses numbers, it uses specific numbers on purpose. And what you're going to notice right here, just as we saw in the book of Numbers, You're going to see one more time that the Israelites were very good at counting and that they use these numbers with mathematic specificity. And when it speaks of numbers of thousands, it keeps track of that number. Notice that these numbers don't change. These ancient Hebrews were actually quite good at counting, quite good at math, could do subtraction and addition, and knew what they were saying when they used the number thousand or variations on it, like 400,000. They actually knew the numbers that they were keeping track of. 26,000 men numbered from Benjamin, and then 700 choice men, 26,700. These are specific numbers on purpose. So don't fall for the notion that numbers in the Bible are arbitrary or that the number thousand simply means, wow, that's a great big number, I can't count, so I'll just say thousand. Throughout the Bible, Old and New Testament, the number thousand always means thousand. It doesn't mean anything but mathematic thousand. Just thought I'd throw that in. That was just added bonus. I'm not even charging extra for that in an effort to make sure that Gladys gets her money's worth. I know.
She cheated us last week.
What'd you say?
The weather cheated us last week.
Yeah, the weather cheated us last week. And you know, it was quite funny. On the internet, there were actually people who commented on that, because the message that was posted was only 35 minutes, and they heard me say, you know, it was the weather, and, you know. And I actually enjoyed, I have to admit, that I liked last week how the thunder punctuated the things I was saying. I would speak of God, and then boom, 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 thunder. And that actually was quite dramatic. I enjoyed it. But there were actually people who felt a little shortchanged last week because they're used to taking a message in the car with them to go to work or something, and it's an hour to work, and so they listen for an hour, and 35 minutes, they had to kill 25 minutes listening to the radio or something, and they were upset. So we'll try not to let them down this week. We're in verse 18 of chapter 20 of the book of Judges, after all those freebies. Now the sons of Israel arose, went up to Bethel, and inquired of God and said, "Who shall go up for us first to battle against the sons of Benjamin?" Remember, they were going to go by course. They weren't all going to go at the same time. So the Lord said, "Judah shall go up first." So the sons of Israel arose in the morning and camped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin, and the men of Israel arrayed for battle against them at Gibeah. Then the sons of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and felled to the ground on that day 22,000 men of Israel. Israel got beat up. The Benjamites were winning. The Benjamites started beating them. And remember, the author already told us they were really good with a sling and could pick off a hare with a sling. So, but the people, the men of Israel, encouraged themselves and arrayed for battle again in the place where they had arrayed themselves the first day. And the sons of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until evening and inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall we again draw near for battle against the sons of my brother Benjamin?" And the Lord said, "Go up against him." Then the sons of Israel came against the sons of Benjamin the second day. And Benjamin went out against them from Gibeah the second day and fell to the ground again 18,000 men of the sons of Israel. All these drew the sword. And all the sons of Israel and all the people went up and came to Bethel and wept. Thus they remained there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening. And they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, for the Ark of the Covenant was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, Aaron's son, stood before it to minister in those days, saying, "Shall I yet again go out to battle against the sons of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease?" And the Lord said, "Go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand." So Israel set men in ambush against Gibeah. Now I will stop right there for a moment, and I will tell you that the third time out, just like God said, they are going to win. They're going to win decisively. Why? Why did God say, "Yes, go," and then they go, and then they get beat bad, and then they have to retreat and start again? They go to God, and they say, "Should we go again?" God says, "Yeah, go again." And they go again, and they get beat bad again. And now they come back and they weep before God and they offer their sacrifices. And then God says, okay, now go a third time. This time I'm going to give them to you. Now you'll notice that he didn't say that the first two times. He said, yeah, go. Oh, yeah, go. But he doesn't say, I'll give them into your hands. The third time he says, this time I will give them into your hands. What I see in this, well, first I ask the question. Anybody want to postulate why it is that God did that?
I think God wanted to make the point that God will give them into their hands. It's not them going out to battle on their own in their own might.
That is one very popular reading and assumption here, conclusion here, is that God was making sure that they understood when they came in at 400,000 and they believed that their cause was just and they agreed as one man that what Benjamin did was wrong. And so God wanted to make sure they realized that the battle still belonged to the Lord and that if they just went in on their own charging in, that they still weren't going to win, that it was up to God when they were going to win. That's one very common commentary solution. Can you think of another reason this might be? Build up Benjamin's confidence, maybe, yeah, so that they're going to fall into the trap the third time. So in that case, it's kind of a tactic of war. But was the sin of Israel really limited to Benjamin? No. We've been reading all the way through this book about the different problems in the different tribes. The sin of Israel is national sin, and God is, as God has done in everything we've read so far in the Old Testament, God uses these warring means to punish people for their sin and for their presumption against God. And here they're warring brother against brother, and yet he still uses the interplay and warfare between the tribes to punish everybody. Everybody gets punished in this. And so God, in his great sovereignty, first kills off thousands,
40,000.
Absolutely, of the Israelites who were coming in to begin with, thinking that their cause was just and that they were on the right side of this. Yeah, they were the ones that were going to straighten it out, and God made sure that they understood that he's the only just one, he's the only right one here, and he'll send them in to die, and then send them in to die again, and then send them in and empower them to make sure that the Benjamites die. And in the end, everybody's taking a huge loss here because really, everybody's guilty. You're nodding. You're agreeing with that? Yeah. And I think all of that is part of it. I think what Tom said is part of it. I think what Carol said is part of it. I think the realization that God in his sovereignty is doing this on purpose tells us that there's there is a purpose, not to be too redundant, but that there is an actual purpose to what God's doing. And whenever he gives up large groups of people to death in battle, it's always a sign of his punishment. So he's punishing not just Benjamin, but he's even picking which tribe goes in first and then letting Benjamin do serious damage. So God in his sovereignty is punishing everybody here because everybody's guilty. So the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, says verse 27. In verse 29, Israel set men in ambush around Gibeah. And the sons of Israel went up against the sons of Benjamin on the third day and arrayed themselves against Gibeah, as at other times. And the sons of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city. And they began to strike and kill some of the people, as at other times, on the highways, one of which goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah, and in the field about 30 men of Israel. And so this time, instead of big death toll, only 30 men of Israel were killed in the field and in the highways. And the sons of Benjamin said, and this is what Carol was alluding to, the sons of Benjamin said, they're struck down before us, just like the first time. But the sons of Israel said, let us flee that we may draw them away from the city to the highways. And then all the men of Israel arose from their place and arrayed themselves at Baal Tamar. And the men of Israel in ambush broke out of their place, even out of Merah Geba. When 10,000 choice men from all Israel came against Gibeah, the battle became fierce. But Benjamin did not know that disaster was close to them. I like that little phrase, by the way, because that was a little poetic license taken by the author. But Benjamin did not know that disaster was close to them. And the Lord struck Benjamin before Israel so that the sons of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day. So the sons of Benjamin saw that they were defeated, says verse 36. When the men of Israel gave ground to Benjamin because they relied on the men in ambush whom they had set against Gibeah, and the men in ambush hurried and rushed against Gibeah, and the men in ambush also deployed and struck all the city with the edge of the sword. Now the appointed sign between the men of Israel and the men in ambush was that they should make a great cloud of smoke rise from the city. Then the men of Israel turned in the battle, and Benjamin began to strike and kill about 30 men of Israel, for they said, "Surely they are defeated before us as in the first battle." That's sort of a recitation of what we already know. But when the cloud began to rise from the city in a column of smoke, Benjamin looked behind them, and behold, the whole city was going up in smoke to heaven. Then the men of Israel turned, and the men of Benjamin were terrified, for they saw that disaster was close to them. Therefore they turned their backs before the men of Israel toward the direction of the wilderness, but the battle overtook them, while those who came out of the city destroyed them that were in the midst of them. They surrounded Benjamin, pursued them without rest, and trod them down opposite Gibeah toward the east. Thus 18,000 men of Benjamin fell. All these were valiant warriors. So let's see, we started out with how many? 26,700. Here we know altogether the total 18,000. The rest turned back and fled toward the wilderness to the Rock of Rimmon, but they caught 5,000 of them there on the highway and overtook them at Gidom and killed 2,000 of them. So that makes 20,000. So all of Benjamin who fell that day were 25,000 men who draw the sword. All these were valiant warriors, but 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to the Rock of Rimmon, and they remained at the Rock of Rimmon for 4 months. And the men of Israel then turned back against the sons of Benjamin and struck them with the edge of the sword, both the entire city and the cattle and all that they found, and they also set fire to all the cities which they found. So, let's do some quick math. If we started out with 26,700, and altogether 25,000, we find out were killed. That leaves us how many? 1,700, but then 600 fled, and worse, they're going to have no mates because they've wiped out everybody in the city. You already read that. That when the city was destroyed, they laid the sword. Man, woman, child took out everybody. And so you've got 1,100 young Benjamites left, and the other tribes have all agreed they're not going to give their women to Benjamin. And so this is the effective end of the tribe of Benjamin. And when they die, it's over. And that's where we find ourselves in chapter 21. Now the men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah, saying, "None of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin in marriage." So the people came to Bethel, and they sat there before God until evening, and they lifted up their voices, and they wept bitterly. And they said, "Why, O Lord God of Israel, has this come about in Israel, so that one tribe should be missing today in Israel?" Notice, by the way, who they cried out to and who they ultimately accredited with the fact that this happened. "Why, O Lord God of Israel, has this come about in Israel?" They're still looking to him as the sovereign and still saying, "Why did you allow this? Why did it come about this way?" Their concept of God at this point is still that God is in control. He's still in charge. And even though these terrible things have happened, they still recognize him as being sovereign over it all.
They would never have killed him without his plan.
Right. Yeah. And he's the one who decided, remember, Judah goes first, and then he wiped out a bunch of Judahites, and then sent them back in again and wiped out some more. Yeah, and then controlled what day they were actually going to win the battle. God made it clear that he was in charge of all this. And so they go back to him and say, why? Why has this happened? It came about the next day that the people arose early and built an altar there and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. That, by the way, is the right response. Worship God. He's still God. He's still on his throne. He's still sovereign. This was awful. Terrible things have happened. We better just worship God. And so they, of course, had burnt offerings and peace offerings in recognition of the fact that there had just been massive bloodshed. There had just been war in Israel. The land has been defiled, and they need to make peace with God. Then the sons of Israel said, who is there among all the tribes of Israel who did not come up in the assembly to the Lord? For they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord at Mizpah, saying, he will surely be put to death. And the sons of Israel were sorry for their brother Benjamin, and they said, one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives, for those that are left, since we have sworn by the Lord not to give them any of our daughters in marriage? And they said, what one is there of the tribes of Israel who did not come up to the Lord at Mizpah? And behold, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. For when the people were numbered, when the count was taken, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. And the congregation sent 12,000 of the valiant warriors there and commanded them, saying, go out and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, with the women and the little ones. And this is the thing that you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every man and every woman who has lain with a man. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him. And they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Now, this is really interesting again. There's a horrible thing that has happened in Israel. Among the Benjamites, there's been a horrible rape and murder. It's a terrible thing. So then the call went out to assemble all the Israelites. The leaders of all the tribes had to come. There had to be the large general assembly. And so they all got together at Mizpah, and they were required to come. And so they said, is there anybody who didn't come? They took the obligation to go defend Israel, the land, the community, the promise, the covenant. They took it so seriously that when they found that somebody didn't come and participate in the job of wiping out the sin that had taken place in Israel, that they said, well, then we're going to go wipe you out. And so the Israelites now go kill off the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead. And when they do it, they take the virgins, but there's only 400 virgins. And the whole congregation sent word and spoke to the sons of Benjamin, who were at the Rock of Ramon, and proclaimed peace to them. So you've got the last of the sons of Benjamin. They're out there. They're hiding. They're at the Rock of Ramon. And they said, okay, enough. We're going to have peace with you now. Benjamin returned at that time. And they gave them the women whom they had kept alive from the women of Jabesh-Gilead. Yet it was not enough for them. And the people were sorry for Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. Notice that language. They felt bad for Benjamin because the Lord had created a breach between the tribes of Israel. They still see God as sovereign over all of these events. And the people were sorry for Benjamin. Verse 16. Now, I have to admit that this next part of the story, as terrible as the story has been up till now, rape and murder and war and killing and destruction of thousands of people, the near destruction of a tribe of Israel who are under covenant promise from God, this is a really dark, dark story. And then it just kind of gets a tad funny. Don't you make that face at me. This just gets really amusing, and you have to see it as being a little amusing. Because this is how they solve the woman problem. There's a very definite, very genuine woman problem. They need women for Benjamin in order for Benjamin to survive. And it's necessary for Benjamin to survive because, remember, all the way back at Jacob leaning on his staff and proclaiming prophecies over the future of the 12 tribes, that he includes future promises for the tribe of Benjamin. And so Benjamin, who was the youngest of the 12 tribes, Joseph's little brother, he's the one that came by Rachel. He's one of the really beloved kids. And so he has to survive somehow, and the way that they decide to find women for Benjamin is just kind of amusing. By the way, as I mentioned, once we get past the book of Ruth, we're then going to get into 1 and 2 Samuel. And when we get into 1 and 2 Samuel, we're going to hear about the first actual kings in Israel. And do you remember who the first king of Israel is going to be? Saul. And do you remember what tribe he comes from? He comes from the tribe of Benjamin. And not only does the tribe of Benjamin continue and thrive and flourish, but Paul, who writes the majority of the New Testament for us, identifies himself as being from the tribe of Benjamin. And so it's an absolute necessity that Benjamin survive. But the way that they go about making sure that Benjamin survives is rather amusing to me, and hopefully to you, especially after I built it up like that. Be kind of a letdown if it wasn't amusing now. So there's an agreement among all the other tribes that they're not going to give them any wives from their own daughters. Verse 19, so they said, behold, there is a feast of the Lord from year to year in Shiloh, which is on the north side of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem, and on the south side of Lebanon. And they commanded the sons of Benjamin, saying, go lie in wait in the vineyards and watch. And behold, if the daughters of Shiloh come out to take part in the dances. Now you have to understand what this was. The virgins would go dance. And they would go outside the city and out to the vineyards. And this was all part of their feast. We know at this point in the history of Israel, they were still keeping the Passover feast. That was kind of the biggest feast of the year. There was a period of time where it appears that rather than going three times a year and keeping their feast, that they had kind of amalgamated them into one big feast. But at very least, in Shiloh, there was this big feast that they had each year. And the children of Israel were very aware of it. And so they conspired and said, look, young Benjamites, here's what you want to do. We know that there's going to be dancing virgins. We know this. And they're going to come out dancing with their tambourines, and they're going to be all dressed up. And we know that this happens every year as part of their feast. So go and watch. And behold, if the daughters of Shiloh come out to take part in the dances, then you shall come out of the vineyard, surprise, and each of you shall catch a wife from the daughters of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. In other words, kidnap a wife from the dancing virgins. This is a dating technique that has not been tried recently. If you could start one of those dating websites that was catchadancingvirgin.com, I mean, you could have some traffic.
It'd be a real reality show.
Exactly. By the way, Devontae smiled at that idea. He seemed enthused by the catch a... Exactly, seven brides for seven brothers. Catch a dancing virgin. Here's a TV show for the fall. So watch and then grab her and take her back to the land of Benjamin. Now, of course, when you do that, that is kidnapping. And so they say to the young Benjamites, now we know you're going to get in trouble for this, so this is what we're going to do. It will come about, verse 22, it shall come about when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, that we will say to them, give them to us voluntarily, because we did not take for each man of Benjamin a wife in battle, nor did you give them to them, or else you would be guilty. So they have an agreement. We're not going to give you any of our daughters. And since we've agreed that we're not going to give you any of our daughters, if you just take some daughters, I know, then we can go argue with the men of Shiloh. When they say, hey, the Benjamites stole our daughters, we'll say to them, okay, but since they did that, just give them to us. Let it be the way it is, because we didn't get them any wives in the battle. We kind of killed everybody. And so since we did that, just let them have them, and you're not guilty of giving them to them because you didn't give them, they took them. So they got them on a technicality. So it's grab a dancing virgin on a technicality. And the sons of Benjamin did so, and they took wives according to their number from those who danced, whom they carried away. And they went and they returned to their inheritance, and they rebuilt the cities and they lived in them. And the sons of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and his family, and each one of them went out from there to his inheritance. And in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that's how the book of Judges ends. Now, it's appropriate that the book of Ruth is inserted right at this point. And we're going to look at the book of Ruth starting next week. Because the book of Ruth then is going to tell us a little bit about the family heritage that leads up to Jesse, that leads up to David, and ultimately leads to Christ himself. And so it's an important story because it also is going to teach us the concept of the kinsman redeemer, which carries all the way into why Christ had to become flesh and blood so that he could be like his brothers, so that he as our nearest kinsman could redeem us. And so we're going to learn all that as we go through the book of Ruth. And the book of Ruth prepares us for what we read in Samuel so that when we read about King David and about Jesse, his father, we know what the lineage and heritage is of that family line. So that's where we pick up next week. Any questions about the book of Judges? We got through that in reasonably quick fashion tonight. Interesting story, huh? Interesting, by the way, the phenomenal honesty of the author of the book of Judges, who didn't hide anything and really told us about the treachery and debauchery and even the chicanery in the way that they found kidnapped dancing virgins for the Benjamites so that that tribe could continue, because in the end, God had planted that tribe and given them land and given them a heritage and given them a promise. And so God protected them in his sovereignty, even as the other tribes were attempting to wipe them out. God limited the amount of bloodshed so that there would at least be a heritage and that that tribe would remain. So again, we see God's sovereignty reigning over the machinations and wildness of men who were doing whatever seemed right in their own mind, not following after godliness, not following after the law, chasing after their own idols, doing whatever seemed right to them. And despite all that, God rules and God reigns and sovereignly moves people around like chess pieces as he works out his ultimate plan in the history of Israel so that he can bring about the king after his own heart, which becomes a type of Christ, which leads to the lineage and family and heritage of Christ, which leads to the Davidic covenant, which points to Christ. And God did all of that through war and bloodshed and sin and debauchery and worship of idols and murder and rape. And through all that, God calls out a man after his own heart and raises up King David and points directly at the Christ to come, who is the solution to all the sin and debauchery and idol worship and murder and all the things that we've read about in Israel up until that point. So, big picture stuff. Yes, ma'am.
Was God sovereign over which Benjamite caught which virgin?
I think in the end, probably yes.
He
would have to be. Yeah, I think that's very funny.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.